Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The modern piano keyboard has 88 keys, and the late Joan Wildman was a master of all of them. Her improvisations would go from low, low bass notes to the very high upper registers. She played stride, blues, bebop, eighth notes, quarter notes, intervals, and sometimes the inner strings and sides of the piano, not just the keys. Wildman taught jazz at UW-Madison for 24 years before retiring in 2002. Before and after leaving UW, she led trios, quartets, quintets, and also performed solo piano, often accompanying it with her own animations. Wildman died last month. Her improvisation transcended music, coloring how she viewed everything from nature to sports. WUWM's Mayon Silver and her brother Eitan were her students and friends. Mayon has this tribute, including a portion of an interview with Wildman from 2016.
Joan Wildman was a force of nature. To watch her play was to witness someone who lived for creativity. She was always inventive and never settled. Here's the sunny portion of a composition of Joan's she wrote shortly before her death called Both Sides of the Street. She wrote in an email, "We can all conjure up what the sunny side of the street looks like, but what about the other side? Which is more important? Do they balance out?" But Joan also knew about the other side, like battling cancer. She knew about saying no to a drug that might prolong her life because it would make her hands and fingers go numb and prevent her from playing the piano that was so much a part of her. Joan grew up in Nebraska and started playing by ear when she was really little. By the time she was 16, when she actually went off to college, she'd heard and loved Charlie Parker and Coleman Hawkins. As a summer job in college at age 17, Joan started playing jazz in a nightclub, six nights a week. But she missed Beethoven and finished her degree in classical music. Here I am talking to Joan in 2016.
Whoa, I never knew this stuff about you.
Okay. Life is long, yeah.
Joan was always doing some sort of jazz playing and then mentioned this, something else I didn't know.
But it really wasn't until, moving to Michigan at one point, Central Michigan University, I worked there, played there, and I had the really wonderful opportunity to play with the Duke Ellington Band when Ellington got sick. And that just sort of, again, was another spurring me on kind of thing.
This is how she describes her pursuit of both classical and jazz.
I was trying to be a piano player, you know, for a long time. Still am. But at the point where, you know, there's a point in your life where you have to really learn a lot of techniques. So I was really concerned. I was playing some concertos with some orchestras at my schools and things like that. And just learning how to play Bach fugues and do them well and do solo recitals and things like that. And I had to learn a lot of really good piano technique, just learn the instrument, not just diddle around with my right hand like I still think too many jazz players do, but use both hands to play the instrument and know what you're doing with both hands, all 10 fingers at the same time. And that's, you know, takes a lot of work. And so in that regard, I guess I was probably trying, I was more focused on the classical part than on the jazz part. But the jazz part was always there.
We're listening to a piece of Joan's called 3x19 from her 1992 album Inside Out. The jazz part became more a reflection of what Joan wanted to express while doing her doctoral dissertation on aleatory music. That's a type of music where some of it is, quote, left to chance. But Joan asked one of the practitioners of aleatory music about what to do if the composers, in this case a guy named Barney Childs, directions say one thing, like to play very softly and only eighth notes, but she feels the music requires loud and fast notes, for instance.
What should I do? Should I rely on my musical instincts, or do I have to rely on that notated little card that Barney Childs had written out? He said, you got to rely on what Barney Childs says at that moment, which I probably knew he would say. But at that moment, I realized, no, it's not aleatory piano music for me, it's jazz. It's improvisation rather than aleatory music. And that was the clincher. It narrowed myself down to just improvisation and the music that I would write that would promote improvisation.
What is improvisation to you?
Just about everything. Just about everything. It's a way of life.
Tell me a little bit about what you mean by that.
It's how I approach the day. It's how I react with people. It's how I raise my children. It's how I cook food. Obviously, it's how I play music. It's how I look at nature. All of that.
And so what would be an example of an improvisation that occurred, you know, this week or last week?
Well, last night I just finished mastering this little cut that we did with my quintet. And so there were a lot of possibilities of ways I could master this particular cut and how I could use these different elements to serve the piece better. And I just decided to figure out ways that maybe I could use this thing going here, and what would happen if I did that, and wouldn't that be fun if I did that? And I'm talking about subtle little things like how much reverb to use, taking reverb off another part of an instrument, just doing things like that, and trying to, not having any preconceived ideas about how it should end or how it should work, but just exploring things. Improvisation is really exploration.
And so with life, like, how do you approach exploration with improvisation in mind with things going on in your life? Like, let's say nature, for instance.
My favorite thing about nature is, I've talked about this a lot of times before, is just looking at a tree and watching the leaves and thinking of each leaf as the breeze goes through the tree leaves, how each branch full of leaves are going to have a particular rhythm, and then another branch is going to have a different tempo and probably different rhythms as well when the breeze hits them. They're all different, and so you have polyrhythms going on all the time with these wonderful, with these leaf movements, and I think that's so wonderful. And you can just hear how it develops, and sometimes if you look at the higher branches, it's going a little bit faster than the lower branches, and so you can just imagine sounds doing that at the same time you're watching the leaves grow, and it would be like a wonderful opportunity if you could actually play those sounds that the movement makes as the tree leaves move.
So the improvisation in the world can affect how you interpret the world, sort of?
Yes, exactly.
Do you think that improvisation is something, some people have an affinity towards it? Do you think that it's something that can be taught, or do you have to have some sort of connection to improvisation in your soul or your personality or something?
I think everybody improvises every day. I think everybody has the opportunity to improvise very well if they work very hard at it. I think it's an attitude. As I say, it can be your whole life. But just the way you walk down the street. Right now, you and I have been improvising because I've not known what questions you were going to ask me. And you probably didn't know what questions you were going to ask me either, you know. And it's just a way of doing things, just walking down the street. What store are you going to look into? What store window are you going to look into? How fast are you going to walk? Are you going to stop and look around a little bit before you take the next step? Or what are you going to do? Everything we do basically is pretty much, only robots are pre-programmed.
How do you think that improvisation like that frees you?
Oh, it's so obvious, I think, how it frees you, because you have the opportunity to do all sorts of things that otherwise you wouldn't be able to. I mean, just Just today, for example, you were coming over, we were going to have lunch, right? And that was going to be a lot of fun, and I thought I would take you out for lunch somewhere. And then I got this note from you that saying, oh, you were going to bring over this, whatever. And I thought, oh, well, that's going to be fun. So I went down to the store and bought something and brought it home. So we didn't go out for lunch. But it was just as much fun going to the store and buying something and bringing it home and enjoying what you brought as well. In fact, it was probably a lot more fun than had we gone out to a restaurant. That's improvisation on a very recent level.
And do you think, actually, I think I was talking to my brother about this, and we were talking about, he remembered that you said about, what was it that you said about Brett Favre versus Aaron Rodgers?
Oh, I've said a lot of things. I don't know if I want to repeat any of the ones.
No, but you just talked about Brett Favre in relation to his improv. I think you mentioned that as a quarterbacking. And I think that's something that a lot of people might understand who may not actually experience jazz from an intellectual standpoint. They might understand that.
Well, Brett Favre just made things up as he went along sometimes. He knew all the techniques that he had to use. I mean, he studied his craft beautifully, as Aaron Rodgers has done as well. But I have a feeling in the back of my mind that Aaron Rodgers just hates to improvise. And he's gotten a little bit more interested in improvisation when he tries to get out of the pocket, when he feels like he has to a lot sooner. But for the longest time, he just has not wanted to try to do something different than what was originally called for. Whereas Brett Favre, he didn't care. You know, he would throw the ball. There might be somebody open, there might not be. But if they're not open, they might get open really fast if it's Brett Favre. And usually the guy would catch it.
Wow, that's pretty cool. And so with politics going on right now in American government and everything, do you see a way that government could be, you know, improved by a jazz viewpoint?
Absolutely. I think one of the things about jazz music and the democracy about it is playing in a group and then having people say what they want to say and to be polite about it. The other people in the band listen to what they have said. And they wait until the other person has finished saying it, and then they come in and say what they want to say. And that would be so helpful in our political situation today if we really had a chance to sit down and listen to what someone else was doing and then waited until they finished before we started saying something else. So that would be a big thing.
Good, this is recording. I freaked out for a minute and thought it might not be recording. But you know what? Jazz would help you let go of that and move on and start afresh, right? Because you have to play the music and let go of it. Can you talk about that a little bit, that experience?
Well, I think, my own experience certainly has been like that. But as far as what other people might realize, it's just looking at Miles Davis and how he was able to play and let go and then start a new style and let go. And his whole dimension of playing with Charlie Parker and doing bebop, and then the stuff even live at Fillmore West, for example, is one of my favorite things that he did later in life. What a difference, a completely different kind of style that he did. And of course, all the modal things that he did in the middle. He was happiest, I think, when he was able to create something new instead of just going back. In fact, he often said about how it wasn't interesting to play the old things over and over and over again, but rather to implement a new way of looking at something, fresh way of looking at something.
Joan herself was a master of this. She was always able to think of new ideas and not play cliches. She was inspired by the musicians she played with, toying with things as simple as an interval or maybe a mood of some kind. She says she always felt like an individual in the long history of jazz creators.
It's nice to listen to other people and then turn them off and go look inside yourself and do something. That's what I think. And it's like the saxophone. You know, you don't want every alto player sounding the same, you know? And then all this time, for the last maybe 20 years, you still have people trying to sound like John Coltrane. And, I mean, that's just a waste of time. John Coltrane died, you know, and he's got a wonderful bunch of music for us to listen to. But you're you, and you live now, and movements come and go, but you are now, and you are you, and you need to create your own thing that says something.
Wow, that's really cool. That's really cool. And you think that that lesson can translate over any undertaking?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Be not afraid. You know, if you fail at something, if it doesn't work out, well, try something else. That's all. Just keep trying to do something that you feel is right and important and makes sense to you.
That was Joan Wildman, the late jazz pianist and UW-Madison music professor, speaking with WUWM's Mayan Silver in 2016. You're hearing a piece called 302 from Joan's 2015 album with bass and flute player Joe Fonda called Conversations. Wildman died in April.